I firmly believe that we deserve, period.
I just feel like it's important to keep saying that aloud, that this is us learning in public.
The foundation of how to not have trash politics is really just relationships, right?
So if you're not aware of how powerful you are, then how can you be using your power to bring others up?
We're giving you collective liberation. We're giving you personal healing. We're giving you millennial auntie with a mic.
You're listening to Scene, the podcast.
I want to begin our podcast episode today with a content and trigger warning that we are going to be discussing the ongoing genocide of Indigenous people in so-called Canada, given the recent recovery and for some discovery of 215 bodies of Indigenous children in Sekwepemc territory in Kamloops at a former residential school. The past few weeks, the two of us have been in some conversation and discussion about how we want to discuss this very painful, very real topic. But before we go further, I also want to note that this podcast is recorded on unceded Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish territories. And the fact that we have the ability to even exist on these lands and have a podcast and speak our minds and our truths and raise up the truths of our communities is a direct result of colonization. And that's something that we can't ever ignore or minimize or relegate to just a land acknowledgement, but we want to start from that place today. So today's episode is obviously heavy, and I want to also infuse a lot of the brilliance and tenacity and strength and spirit of Indigenous people here on Turtle Island. So our BIPOC of the week is founder and CEO of Nanahi Creative, Tatalia Michelle Nanahi of the Squamish Nation. And Tatalia is a decolonial creative and strategist catalyzing social change to transform colonial narratives and impacts. She works within the intersection of class, culture, and creativity, focusing on social change through communications and deep engagement. Tatalia's collaborations have influenced opinions, changed behaviors, and mobilized community action. So a lot of the work we're talking about today is from Tatalia, and you can check out her work on her website, and you can follow her on Instagram. Her Instagram is Decolonize First, and her website is decolonizeeverything.org, which I just like love the title of the website and have a lot of respect and gratitude for all of the work that Nanahi Creative is putting out for free a lot of the times. The pieces that we're going to be covering today are on Nanahi Creative's Instagram at Decolonize First. So I want to take a big deep breath because I feel responsible in terms of guiding this conversation and for us to have a dialogue. I feel responsible to do it in a way that recognizes the magnitude of the harm and also doesn't center my feelings and also, you know, centers the feelings and the experiences of Indigenous people. So yeah, I didn't really know where to start in thinking about and planning this episode, but thanks to the brilliance of Tatalia and what she shares on Instagram, we're going to have a really, I think, helpful framework to move through this discussion. I want to just do a check-in with you, Lala. I know your health isn't doing the best, and I want to see how you are and where you're at in jumping into this conversation.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for that introduction and the content warning and the trigger warning. My health is not the best. I'm definitely in a lot of pain right now, physically, and feeling pretty emotionally raw as well. And yeah, it's not, I don't want to center my feelings either, but I also think it's so important for us as settlers to be emotionally connecting to what's happening always. So I guess we'll be trying to walk that line of being kind of grounded and tuned into ourselves without centering ourselves in the conversation. So not always easy, but it's a practice.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that. How do we walk that line of connecting emotionally? Because I think, and what I'm learning is the more we try to push ourselves away from the gravity, the enormous pain, the devastation, the more that colonial ways of existing thrive. Colonization thrives when we live in disconnection from ourselves, from our spirit, from the land, from the people who have always taken care of the land and been on the land. So yeah, just recognizing the magnitude, right, of like finding 215 remains of Indigenous children is massive, and it's devastating and it's painful. And as so many Indigenous folks have been saying, it's likely just the beginning. And is connected to so many ongoing, existing, current, contemporary sites of violence that Indigenous people are navigating and are being forced to survive through today.
Yeah, it's not the first time something like this has been identified. And of course, survivors have always known this and have always told us this. And yeah, I think you're right that colonialism thrives when we don't connect emotionally, because there's no way that if we were connecting emotionally, this would have ever been allowed to happen in the first place. Like, you have to be so deadened to everything, to yourself, to others, to spirit, to everything, in order for such harm to be perpetrated on another human being, no less a child. So part of breaking the cycle as settlers is showing up emotionally.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, and I shared this online on my Instagram, is when I first came across the news, the recovering of these 215 bodies of Indigenous children, and also saw the way that the media, the news, folks on in digital spaces were responding who are not Indigenous, and I'm specifically speaking about white folks. There was a lot of like shock, a lot of like surprise, disbelief, like how could this happen? And a lot, of course, of folks circulating important reflections, calls to action, posts from Indigenous folks, right? And I think, as we were just mentioning, like the what's the fine line? How do you straddle not centering yourself and your feelings, but also connecting with your feelings? Because that's required work in decolonizing, connecting with our spirit and our emotions to compel us into action. It just reminded me of the way that I felt last year in 2020 when documented footage of Black people being murdered was once again on camera, on film, and the expression of surprise that this can't be us, that how could this happen, that, you know, all of those sorts of responses to something so vile, and how exposed I felt, how vulnerable I felt. It was like a fresh wound was open, because it's not as if Black folks hadn't been talking about the things that our ancestors and people who look like us have been forced to survive. And so in seeing the news of the 215 children remains being found, I couldn't help but draw that comparison of just what it might be like to be an Indigenous person on the timeline, seeing people shocked and surprised, as if Indigenous people haven't been talking about the genocide that they have been forced to endure in so-called Canada at the hands of the Catholic Church, at the hands of so many institutions. And so my heart was really just broken because I was thinking to myself, and I connected with some of my like close Indigenous friends just to say, hey, like, if this is anything like I was feeling, I just wanted you to know that I'm there for you. And it just really, just showing up for my Indigenous friends just really ripped me apart, because just the amount of pain and the real feeling of like almost betrayal, like, how did you not believe all of us? Did you not see it? Did you ignore it? Did you think we were making it up? You know what I mean? The selective outrage and what that really can feel like when people are upholding this idea as if this is a surprise, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of the problem and part of why this is still ongoing is that it isn't our shared understanding of what Canada fundamentally is, and the fact that it's even on Indigenous people to tell us and continually keep telling us. You know, like, we had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but I mean, there was so much more work to be done after that that has not been done. And also, the truth from that has not become the shared Canadian narrative and understanding of ourselves that it needs to be. You know, like, I don't know, far be it for me to talk about another country, because I don't know the, you know, full political climate and I don't know the whole story. But my understanding is that in Germany, for example, it's illegal to deny the Holocaust. Just offering that as one kind of small piece or example of how things could be different, you know, and the fact that we're not even coming close in Canada to what we would need to do to change things and to even have the audacity to talk about reconciliation, you know?
Absolutely. It's been 6 years. It's been 6 years since the TRC. And you're right, we haven't gotten anywhere closer to material conditions changing for Indigenous people. And I'm grateful to you for bringing up looking to other jurisdictions about how they have done some repairing work to address genocide. Mm-hmm. And so I want to introduce some really helpful pieces that Tatlia Michelle Nanahy posted on Decolonize First on Instagram. And she posted several pieces on the five stages of grieving settler colonialism. And I want us to use that as a framework for our discussion today. And she graciously educates all of us and shares some of these markers of what these stages look like. So the first stage being denial. She writes that markers of denial include sentiments like, they, meaning Indigenous people, just need to get over it. It happened a long time ago. It had nothing to do with me. And actions that do not include any kind of self-work in tandem with systemic work. And as you were just mentioning what happens in Germany and that it is illegal to deny the Holocaust, like, in Canada, we're still having a person in the highest office refer to genocide as a dark chapter in the history of our nation. Like, I want to know what fucking book you're reading. Like, how are we relegating this to such a far away historical, just a sliver of what it means to be here, to exist, to have Canada be in existence? And so when we talk about denial, this, it reminds me of our previous conversation that we've had about trauma culture and how it's like we're so ill-equipped to talk about what really has happened and what the harm really is.
Yeah, that was our episode, Second Nature. And I think there's so many layers here. I think part of it is that so many settlers have lived, you know, quite relatively free lives here, and so have no kind of visceral understanding of what that would be like to have the RCMP come and forcibly steal your 5-year-old child. You know, and for that to happen to entire communities, entire peoples, like, I think there's just so many of us that are, again, cut off from that. And then I think there's also the trauma culture piece of, like, the horrific kinds of abuse and, you know, neglect and whatever other kinds of traumas lots of people have experienced, you know, even settlers. You know, there's still, you know, family abuse and the sort of just interpersonal traumas that happen, and are shutting off from that, from those feelings, in order to not be overwhelmed by them, makes us deadened and unable to empathize on this very basic human level with something so tragic, you know, because I know for me, I obviously have never experienced something like either being taken to residential school or having a child of mine taken. And when I really say it and sit with it, it's like a stomach churning kind of like devastation, you know, like we should be able to feel the truth of that as humans, right? Whether we've experienced or not. And yet so many Canadians, so many settlers are so quick to try to dismiss it or downplay it. It's very, very disturbing.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. And you just mentioned that we should be able to sit with the truth of that and to feel the truth. But so many of us, so many settlers can't even hear the truth. There's this willful, intentional denial of the truth of how Indigenous people are forced to survive in so-called Canada. Mm-hmm. There's this attitude of like, so what more do you want? Like, you get this and you get that and this, and there are these like narratives, these fables, these unreal, mm-hmm. these false truths that people hold on to and cling to, that obscure our ability to see the ways that basic safety, basic health, basic care, because this is, I want to contextualize the recovery and discovery of these bodies in a bigger context, that actually many Indigenous people are not getting their basic needs met. And I think what you just said about the disturbing nature of how we're so able to be flippant is also that we're so comfortable with doing nothing. Mm-hmm. And we don't realize that this is exactly what the so-called Canadian government wants us to do, which is nothing, mm-hmm. right? They want us to do nothing, feel nothing, say nothing, you know, call out nothing. And it's also important for us to think about the ways that these false truths about how Indigenous people exist in Canada today, how that storytelling is intentional, right? How invested Canada is in invisibilizing and erasing and minimizing the harms of genocide and of residential schools and of the 60s scoop and of the repeated ways that the governments continue to fail and in fact enact violence against Indigenous people. And, you know, the truths that we're talking about have to include the fact that Indigenous people are having to fight to exist on their own lands. And I so often I think I've heard, you know, in passing, and I've seen things on the internet, and I'm always like, what echo chamber are people in, right? To adhere to these false truths when there's so much information that exists.
There absolutely are echo chambers, and the realities of life as an Indigenous person within the illegitimate borders of the Canadian state are very much made marginal and made invisible by settler institutions of all kinds, educational, the media, political, everything. Our very image of ourselves as Canadians is something that so many settlers are very unwilling to let go of. You know, like, we are brought up to believe that this place that we have created somehow, Canada, is this multicultural haven. And I keep thinking about the UN, the ways that we see ourselves as this kind of world leader and role model, and that we are a nation of peacekeepers, you know, like, we contribute to the peacekeeping missions in these, like, third world countries where these horrible things happen because we have this moral high ground. You know, that's really what settlers are raised to believe. And the reality is, we need the UN to come in and investigate and deliver reports and give mandates for things to change, because this is a genocide. And it's like you said, I mean, it's not just one thing. It's like, even one of the things, residential schools on their own is such a horrific atrocity and crime against humanity. But it's not even just that. It's the boil water advisories. It's Grassy Narrows. It's the Canadian government continuing to fight First Nations kids in court. It's very much ongoing, and we, the Canadian state, like, we can't be trusted to correct this on our own, obviously, because we've had our entire existence to, and we just keep doing the same thing. So we actually need the UN to come in here. But that is, like, a challenge to the settler kind of psyche that, you know, we're not allowing it to happen.
The second stage is anger. And Tatalia writes, when you first move beyond denial, you will encounter anger. Some will never process it and may return to denial, stuck in a neo-colonial loop between denial and anger. And when you were just speaking, I had to catch my breath, because, like, a wave of just, like, and we're going to get to sadness soon as one of the stages, but a wave of both sadness, but also just deep amounts of rage. And that it has to be, it can no longer be acceptable that we expect Indigenous people to wait for things to change. Like you just said, it's the specificity of residential schools is enormous in and of itself. And that almost feels debilitating to move into another, you know, to another thing and then another thing. And so I just can't stop coming back to anger in this. Also, anger for the ways that we, as racialized folks, as many of us, children of immigrants in some way, shape, or form, mixed folks like yourself too, all of the stories that we tell ourselves to legitimize our existence here and our continued denial of our role in ongoing harms of Indigenous people. Because I want to hold that, like, there are many of us whose families were displaced, and that is why we're here. like many of our family members have fled places to come to another place in the world because of colonialism. But I stop there when it comes to some of the ambivalence, maybe some of the ways that it can be really easy to say, oh, it's like white settlers. It's like, well, how do we personally benefit, you and I, you know, mm-hmm. from where we are, from our ability to live on the land that we are? And I think there's also anger that I have for myself, and then anger more broadly for everyone, you know?
Yeah, we live on stolen land. Everything about our lives exists on this foundation of violence. We may not have the most power or the loudest voice, but we're very much used in service of that power and that voice. The picture of multiculturalism. If we are just silent about that, we allow that to continue. So if we're not very vocally on the side of Indigenous peoples, we're very much complicit and on the side of the settler colonial genocidal Canadian state. And it doesn't really matter that it harms us too, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't harm me the most. And even if it harms me too, that doesn't remove my responsibility and my complicity in the harm against others.
Yeah, when you were speaking, it made me think of the ways that through multiculturalism, I think we've like learned to coalesce and go along with this idea of this imaginary Canada. And even when things happen in our racialized communities, we aren't able to meet the moment a lot of the times in repudiating and calling it colonialism and talking about white supremacy. We individualize it to just, you know, our own little pocket in the world. And I think when even in doing that, I think it gives the colonial state more of a foothold to say, see, look, we support this subsection of immigrants, we stand with them. But up until the point we say that the reason that we're able to experience these types of hate crimes, or the reasons that we're able to, that we're being targeted in this way, isn't because of how I dress or how I look, it's because of white supremacy, you know, and making that connection. Maybe a lot of us don't have the words or the tools to make that connection, but I think deep down we know. We know what it is, right? It's this, again, going back to like denial. It's so much easier to talk about somebody's indiscriminate hatred as opposed to talking about white supremacy, because white supremacy for a lot of folks feels like all it can possibly be are people in white hoods, when it's the function, it's been the mode by which genocide continues in Canada.
Yeah, and so much of what you said just lights a fire within me around the importance of organizing, you know, because it's not an individual problem. There is no individual solution, and not all of us have all of the tools that we need. Some of us have some of the tools, and I feel like that's why it's so important for us to be organizing together, because we need to get to speaking truth and naming what's happening, but that's just one step. And there's so much more that we need to be doing. And that's why we really need to like find each other and support each other as settlers to organize.
Absolutely. We'll get into what we need to be doing. Another stage of grieving settler colonialism is the third stage, which is bargaining. And Tatalia writes, recognition without redress, acknowledgement without accountability, and apology without action. I feel like this is where we're at as like a collective settler society, is again this expectation that slow progress is still, it's just, it's good. Just wait, just hold on. It's coming. this like, look, we're, our government is better than the previous government. Remember what Harper did? It's like, it's the same fucking shit. And how I see that connected to bargaining is like this idea that slow progress is worthwhile when material conditions result in ongoing violence against Indigenous folks. And like this notion that waiting on the slow wheels of progress will get Indigenous people closer to what apparently the settler state wants, which is like reconciliation, which really isn't reconciliation. What we want is for Indigenous people to no longer really exist anymore. Like that's what the state seems to want, because if they didn't, they would be acting a lot faster.
Well, and I think what you just said, it really underscores how much the entire Canadian project has been genocide. Like there has always been a particular strategy to get rid of Indigenous people so that the Canadian state can do what it wants with the land.
Yes.
Right. Yes. And so that's looked like a lot of things over the years and the decades. And, you know, maybe the most recent thing is a sort of quote unquote, like reconciliation where you can be like one of the squares in the multicultural mosaic, but not actually having to listen to Indigenous people, not actually having to give Indigenous people their land back, not having to actually grapple with what quote unquote reconciliation would mean from an Indigenous perspective or from multiple Indigenous perspectives, if quote unquote reconciliation is even what Indigenous peoples want, you know. And there's a lot, again, a lot of different nations and a lot of different perspectives, but it's very clear that certainly from the Canadian state's perspective and from the perspective of, I guess, is it fair to say most settlers, is let's just make this problem go away so we can just keep living our lives the way we want on the land without having to sacrifice
anything
that we have.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just not how it works, right?
Yeah, no, it's not. And something that was said on the Nora and Sandy Talk Politics podcast that came out recently, I will add it to our show notes, I guess. but anyways, they were talking about this topic, about the mass grave. And something that resonated was this notion that progressives need to get it out of their mind that the solutions will happen in parliament. And mm-hmm. It made me think about how many times Indigenous folks have talked about, like, how are we going to get justice through colonial court systems, right? Like, looking to the systems that have caused the harm to fix the harm. Canada is so invested in the status quo. It's so invested in continued colonization. And something that you literally just said about the land. So Christy Belcourt tweeted, Canadians need to connect the dots between residential schools and resource extraction, between child welfare and resource extraction, between missing, murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people and resource extraction. It's always been about the land.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that Canada is invested in the status quo means that when Canada does something, when Canada and all of its instruments of genocide do something, we end up learning that the work that they've done has fallen short. Because do they really have an invested interest in changing the material conditions of Indigenous people's lives? Right. So like last week, the federal government shared its national action plan and federal pathway on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which already the Union of BC Indian Chiefs have stated is an inadequate response to the crisis of murders and disappearances and the ongoing genocide against Indigenous women and girls and Two-Spirit, LGBTQ, queer, IA plus people. That was identified in the national inquiry, and it's 231 calls for justice. So I'm going to continue because the Union of BC Indian Chiefs also shared in the same press release that the plan that was released does not answer how to keep Indigenous women, girls, and 2S LGBTQIA+ people safe, It has no specific information about how, when, and by whom concrete actions will be taken. Nowhere in the document do governments acknowledge and accept responsibility for the laws, policies, and practices that contribute to and perpetuate the ongoing genocide of Indigenous peoples, and specifically of Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit, LGBTQ, QIA plus people. So there is like this big energy that I feel right now in just reading that, that the work that is being done on the part of the government is not enough. I don't even think it will ever be enough.
It's performative, right? And it's hypocritical. It's like, look at what else they're doing. They release this and continue to fight First Nations kids in court, you know, like it's always been an unbroken line of colonial violence, and they can release some kind of quote unquote action plan and then continue to not actually carry it through. But it sounds nice, and that's pretty much all settlers need to just sort of continue going about our business and act like, okay, an action plan was released. Great, that's the end.
The fourth stage of grieving settler colonialism is sadness. And Tatalia writes, our elders have shared that sadness is the healing feeling, that our tears are sacred and needed, and that they are integral to transformation. And the sadness piece, it's like when you connect the dots, like with Christy Belcourt's tweet about how everything is about the land. When we connect the dots, the depths of violence and depravity and harm are overwhelming. This idea that it's like this is complicated is a lie. It's very clear. It's clear as day that all of these forms of oppression are intentional, that are all, they're all forms of settler colonialism. And I think with the sadness piece, like I've cried so many times about this news. And one thing that I want to raise up is that Indigenous people are right now are asking us to no longer deflect and focus on like individual issues that harm Indigenous folks, but really like zoom the fuck out. Mm-hmm. And see the interconnectedness of these harms and these violations that have been experienced by Indigenous folks across Turtle Island, and really coming to terms with the weight of that overwhelming pain. The fifth stage is acceptance. Tatalia writes, moving into acceptance of settler colonialism does not mean it's acceptable. It means you've done the personal work needed to contribute in a centered way. The work is nonlinear, so it's easy to slide back to denial or bargaining or anger, but staying in good relations with acceptance brings you back to center. And so this is the space where we really need to be figuring out our role forevermore. Because I think, like we saw last year, people were like, Black Square, post, send some money, that's it. This is an ongoing commitment that I know we all need to make as folks who are not Indigenous and are not descendants of folks who have been stolen from lands and brought here. We need to do this work. And so the notion of like getting in where we fit in and really figuring out what knowledge, skills, privileges we can leverage to work for change in a deliberate and ongoing and sustainable way is crucial.
Yeah. And again, this is where I think organizing is so crucial. And I don't mean that everybody needs to be an organizer. It's quite the opposite. But again, it's not an individual problem. We can't fix it by ourselves. And the more we're just in isolation, one person, you know, trying to give some money, write a letter to an MP or something, like there isn't that much you can do as one person. So I think it's really important to be having conversations with our friends and our families and our communities, our coworkers, whoever it might be, to find, okay, this is what I have. What do you have? Or even I really struggle maybe to read and understand certain kinds of information. This friend of mine, I feel like they seem to really get it more. Can you just explain it to me, please? You know, asking for what we need, and then trying to figure out as groups, like, how we can be most effective, as well as how we can support each other. Because now here's a place where we're walking a line between not centering ourselves, but being tuned in. I saw, and trigger warning to any Indigenous people who might be listening, and also any marginalized people, because honestly, this is kind of what people in power say all the time, which is things like, well, what, like, we're just, you know, we're just trying to survive too. Like, we're all overwhelmed. We've all got a lot going on, you know, that kind of thing. And it's an excuse. I've been seeing that a lot on social media in the comments or in the replies. And it's absolutely a cop-out.
Yeah.
And sitting here as someone who's chronically ill, who's like in a lot of pain right now, who's like struggling. Yeah, lots of people are having a hard time and struggling. That doesn't mean we're off the hook.
Yeah.
But it does mean that as settlers, we need to be supporting other settlers and doing the work to make it possible for other settlers to show up. Like, let's figure out childcare, right? Like, let's figure out rides. Like, let's figure out things that really allow us to show up, like remove some of the barriers. And we need to be doing this for each other, and like obviously completely leaving Indigenous people out of this, because it is absolutely never their job to worry about any of that. But we need to, as settlers, like, we're each other's problem.
Yeah, I'm so grateful that you mentioned just the need for us to be in connection with each other on these issues, and to be talking about these things with our family members, our friends, our communities. And like, there's a lot of power there, if only to dispel myths that people in our families or households or friends have bought into about what the state of Canada really is. How can we challenge the way that we act and believe survivors and hold relationships with where we are, like the land that we're on and the people who are stewards of the land that we are on? And if we're not sure about the people who are the stewards of the land that we're on, then it's our responsibility to go and find information about where those people were displaced, mm-hmm. and how we can show up in support of the things that they need. Because I think, I love that you were talking about like rides, like the material conditions need to change quickly. And I know I had mentioned like, oh, people giving money, but like mutual aid is a must right now. Like, get plugged in to the people who are up in Fairy Creek and the people who are in Wet'suwet'en and the people who need supplies, and give cash into people's hands directly. It is the very least we can do, because the things that they are doing, the things that Indigenous people are doing in these places, is fighting for their fucking existence, fighting for their ability to survive. So we need to be funding that. That's bare bones shit that we need to do.
Yeah, I think as much as we need to do our own work as settlers and organize ourselves as settlers and never ask Indigenous people to do work for us, Indigenous people have always been resisting and fighting and doing incredible work against colonization. And so that work does exist. We can go and find it and support it. And if you don't know where, you know, ask your friends, DM us, like, get out there. There are other settlers that you can ask to find the Indigenous people who are already doing this work, so that we can support that work that's already happening.
Before we close, I just want to offer two important questions that I want to be like guided in answering. today and tomorrow and all the days that follow. And those questions are, how are we actually honoring the legacy and the work of Indigenous people's continued fights and calls for justice and action? Like you just said, Lala, like there's Indigenous folks have been resisting this entire time. They're still here because they've been resisting this entire time. So what are we actually doing to honor that work? And then further to that, what work are we taking off the shoulders of Indigenous people who are fighting ongoing genocide? So I want to leave and close with those two reflection questions and express a lot of gratitude to you, Lala, for being here with me and for us to have this conversation. And I hope that we can continue to talk about these in between the revelations and the things that come up in the news. I know that we do all often, but I think that what we know to be true is that there's going to be likely more stories, more recoveries. And so we need to get our shit together. Mm-hmm. Truly.
Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.